Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. The World Transformed is an audio production of Speculist Media. You can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your world, in your life, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I am doing just great. Super fantastic. That's pretty much been the your state for about 3 or 4 years that.
Well, my whole life, but I started saying it out loud the last three or four years. I think I've gotten more super fantastic by saying it. And I'm glad to hear you say it, you know, once in a while, you know, just own it, you know, you're super fantastic. That's all there is to it. Well, we've got a good one tonight. We're holding reasonably true to our formula. We've always said with a fine Pareto analysis, that we should do about 80-20. 80% of the talking that we do on this program, the exploring that we do, is around all the great stuff that can happen. And 20% of our focus should be around preventing bad things from happening. So we want to spend a certain amount of time looking at the good side. That's not hard for us. We're kind of inclined to do that anyway. And then about, one-fifth of the time, about 20% of the time, looking at the potential downsides. Now, we're on our sixth show, so we're running a little behind, but not really, because I think our last couple of shows we've gotten into some risks and downsides and some of those kinds of things already. So I don't feel that we've completely blown it. And now tonight we're doing a whole show devoted entirely to things to be worried about.
Right. And I think that in fairness to us, Bill, we probably hit a few of the worries with almost every show. You know, I mean, We're optimists by nature, but to explain our optimism, we have to at least outline what some of the worries are, and we generally do. So, tonight's here's stuff that we genuinely have some concern about, and we're going to go through them.
Bad news all the way, all the way down. Well, and in fact, it's not. It's with a positive goal in mind, and that positive goal obviously is these are things that we wish to avoid, things that we wish to prevent occurring. These are the outcomes that we don't want to happen, right? So we're gonna spend a little bit of time tonight talking about what we're scared of, specifically for the reason of helping to prevent those things from coming about. I'm going to share the first of the links that I provided in the show description, both on theworldtransformed.com and over on Blog Talk Radio, up in the chat room right now. And this is the piece on Motherboard. So actually, I've linked to a couple of pieces. On Motherboard, they had a great summary. And on edge.org, is the actual collection of essays. And this is an annual custom that they have at Edge, which is to every year they ask a question, they put it out to this brain trust. I mean, this group of super intelligent, highly accomplished people, and ask them to provide their answer. And the question this year was 2013, what should we be worried about? So we've got 150 answers to that, and I'll go ahead and I'll share the edge.org responses too. And it's a sobering list. Would you agree?
Yeah, and so, you know, not every worry that's listed there is like 50, correct? Not every worry I share, but even the stuff that's, you know, I can kind of go, yeah, I'm not too terribly worried about it. I can see the reason that, you know, someone would have a concern about almost every one of these. And so, yeah, every one of them is worth talking about. Unfortunately, an hour is not long enough to go through 150 worries. So
we're
going to
just
kind of pick out our favorite worries.
pick out a few personal faves and also contribute one or two of our own. We wanted to demonstrate that the 150 smartest people in the world are they got nothing on us when it comes to finding out things to worry about. So in addition to items from that list, I've got one contribution of my own that I'll bring up, Stephen, and I trust you've got one as well.
I've got two.
Oh, okay. Well, you've got twice as many as me, I guess, is what you're basically saying. And that's impressive. You know, the thing that really struck me about this list as I was reading through it, particularly when I started reading some of the essays, is this is an opportunity to talk about some problems and some risks other than the ones that we've talked about before, both on Fast Forward Radio and on our special series, The World Transformed, and on the few shows that we've done up to now. Because we know what the big ones to be worried about are. We've done shows about that. We've talked about existential risk, and that's going to include things like old favorites, you know, the hard singularity, the artificial intelligence that doesn't like us or doesn't care about us, the nanotech gone amok that turns into gray goo and liquefies the whole planet. Ecological disasters, nuclear war, massive astronomical events that could potentially wipe us out. So we've talked about all those. And because we've talked about those, I actually picked items from the list that were different from those. I actually went with some completely new things to be worried about. So I feel pretty good about the fact that if you feel like you've heard me talk about what to be scared of before, hopefully tonight you'll get some brand new things to be afraid of.
And you know what I'm not worried about is running out of things to talk about in this show.
No, that's not going to be an issue. Okay, so why don't we with that caveat, why don't we leap into it? And you want to go first? You want me to go first?
I'll go first. I'll just jump right on out there. Number 58 on the list was that will become like rats stuck in a blue marble trap. Now, obviously, what's being talked about here is that we're stuck on Earth, you know, that we're unable to in any meaningful way depart for other places in the universe. And, you know, this gravity well business has been a bit of a tough nut to crack, at least economically. You know, if you throw all the money in the world, you can maybe put a half dozen men on the moon. But, you know, how do we get start a new colony or civilization somewhere besides this planet? I think that's a legitimate concern, there are some reasons to be hopeful.
Definitely, the last couple of years,
I
would say the last year or so has provided some really good signs of progress and reason for hope along those lines. Would you agree?
Yeah, one of the big things that a lot of hope is that we've seen the arrival in many ways of a true space race, a true space age, in that people are going to space to make money, and the private sector is really taking up where the, you know, governments were formerly involved in putting people in space. We're beginning to see that you know, corporations do it for money. And, you know, sometimes it's people they're putting up, but more often it's probably going to be robotics and AIs. But I think these are some of the first steps towards making it economical to start and colonies, civilizations elsewhere. So I am concerned about that. And one of the big concerns is Stephen Hawking, how he has mentioned a number of times that we shouldn't have all our eggs in one basket. You know, if you do have gray goo or AI run amok or, you know, synthetic biology getting away from you, then or some serious problem like that, wouldn't it be awesome if everything that you needed to kickstart or restart human civilization were also on Mars? Or some, you know, or someplace distant enough that whatever problem it was they'd be insulated from.
Think about it this way: if all of humanity were sufficiently small group of people that they could all live in one city, then anything that could wipe out a city could wipe out all of humanity. So that's pretty scary. But we're not that small. We occupy an entire planet. And so we're more resilient than if we were that small and if we were that limited in space. But it's still a finite space, and it's still the kind of space that can be at risk ultimately, particularly if you take the very long view, and if you look at what has happened to some of the living things that have occupied this planet before us. I was really impressed. I picked my daughter up from preschool this afternoon and asked her what she talked about today, and she said dinosaurs. And I said, what did you learn about dinosaurs? And she said, they're extinct, which I thought was a pretty good word for a 3-year-old. But we know that level of event occurs on this planet. It's happened several times before, and that's not even as bad as some of the things that that potentially could happen, some of the things that we've talked about on the show before. And they're all... So a lot of the risks that you look at that potentially could wipe out humanity have to do with the fact that we're stuck here on one planet. If we're not, if the whole species isn't living on this planet, then those are still terrible risks, and it would be horrible to have so many people killed. But all of humanity wouldn't necessarily be wiped out if we were spread out elsewhere in the solar system, and especially if we were spread out into interstellar space. We'd become much, much harder to eradicate at that point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree completely.
So that's a good one. And that was, I want to note, that was by Gregory Benford, who has been a guest on our program in the past.
Yep.
Physics professor and science fiction writer. And also he used to write the, what was it called? The Scientist Notebook column for Analog Magazine. I remember reading that growing up. One of my things I look forward to every month. All right, I've got one.
What I found impressive about your last monologue, Phil, is you were able to throw in the proud dad right in the middle of it and not even skip a beat.
It just occurred to me that I was, you know, I've been talking extinction all day. It's interesting, you know.
Well, you know, I guess that's the ultimate worry, isn't it? So we got to. And here's how we avoid extinction, you know, all these different paths to extinction. I guess that's what the show's about tonight. So.
Yeah, well, yeah. It put me on that mindset, because they didn't get into how it happened in school. And so driving home, I had to formulate an explanation as to how the whole thing occurred. And then we ended up talking about it again at dinner. So I really have been on extinction all day. Well, here's one not quite as serious as extinction, but still a serious worry. This is from Esther Dyson, and she says, we should be worried about the consequences of our increasing knowledge of what causes disease and its consequences for human freedom. This is number 96 on the list. And I'll read just a little bit from her essay on this. I think this is really interesting. She says, in this case, the trigger is our increasing knowledge of how we make ourselves sick or how we can keep ourselves healthy. Proper diet, regular exercise, no smoking, limited drinking, sufficient sleep. In other words, it's becoming pretty clear that a squeaky clean lifestyle, and just for good measure, add in avoidance of stress, is the key to good health for most people and to reducing medical costs dramatically for society as a whole. In short, the notion of unpredictable health catastrophes is giving way to something closer to floodplains, People are rightly asking whether society should pay to protect people who live in predictably dangerous areas, refuse to wear helmets while riding motorcycles, and so on. But when somebody actually undergoes such a catastrophe, even a predictable one, attitudes change and the government offers disaster relief. So the questions are, what do we have to do to live properly? What responsibility do we have for the consequences if we do not? How much can we blame on our parents or society or whomever? And even so, what responsibility do we bear? Should our society pay for the prevention but not for remediation of avoidable outcomes? This is a really interesting question, because this takes shape in debates that you see. You see these occasional news stories about, is it okay for an employer not to hire smokers? Just have a policy. If you smoke, even outside the office, you can't work here because we don't want to pay those insurance premiums. Or is it okay for an employer not to hire fat people? Right. Is it okay for Mayor Bloomberg in New York to ban big sodas? I think we've actually talked about that one in the past. And where does this ultimately lead? How into way up into our business does society, our employer, our government ultimately get in the process of trying to keep us alive, both for our own good and for the good of society by mitigating those costs and keeping those costs down? And I see Esther's point here. I think she makes an excellent point, and I think this is a very real risk. And I think this is something that is probably going to see a lot more of it before we see too much pressure moving away from it. Is my immediate guess. What do you think, Stephen?
There is an efficient society, and there's a free society, and not always are they the same thing.
Right.
I believe that freedom is the better way to go. I'll give you a story. I'm not sure where I picked this story up, but basically there was this lady went missing. She was a mom and a wife, and she just, without any explanation, just went missing. And this huge manhunt was started and everything. And I mean, lots of taxpayer dollars were put into this manhunt. Ultimately, she was found, and it just turns out that she just couldn't stand the sight of her husband and needed a break. And she'd been gone for about a week, came back, and so the question was raised: should she be charged with anything? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they decided not to charge anything, and it was just there's a lot of discussion about it. And one of the things they just basically said was, everybody's free to wig out, and you have the freedom of movement, and not every time you go someplace do you have to check in with people.
Right.
Did you cost the taxpayers a lot of money by that? Absolutely. Was it irresponsible? Especially as a parent, you bet.
Yeah.
But
bad behavior, any way you look at it, for sure.
Yeah, it's bad behavior. But, at least, I can understand if he's a jerk or whatever, getting away from him, but, let somebody know.
Yeah.
But should it be something that should be prosecuted for? Absolutely not. And should Mayor Bloomberg take away my super-sized, I can jump in it and swim around, big gulp? No. It's none of his business. I ought to be able to buy, and I ought to be able to abuse my body any way I like. Do I buy big gulps like that? Absolutely not. I don't, because I'm interested in sticking around. I want to live to see it, But I don't. I take offense at nanny state-ism, and so.
Well, so but hey, but Stephen, so do I. Okay, and I think so does Esther. I think the question is. Do you see it going that way? I
think there's been a lot of creeping nanny statism over the last 10, 15 years. And no, I don't care for it. And, how does technology play into this? I think in some ways it cuts both ways, doesn't it? I mean, if you got an all-powerful government watching every move you make with video cameras everywhere, that's not good. But with technology, people are empowered as well to do all kinds of things that a statement appreciates.
I think it's better if people get healthier and take care of themselves on their own, because they get smart enough and they start to do that. And I know there's always going to be some tension between those two things, but it does seem that we're very much moving in the direction of having all of this taking care of ourselves handed to us top down. And I think it's a very bad direction to go. And eventually people are going to push back. Eventually enough people are going to realize, wait a minute, you don't get to tell me what to do, right? You don't get to tell me what to eat, how much sleep I'm supposed to get. Ultimately it's going to come down to sex or reproductive rights or something like that. This is going to creep into areas of life where people are finally just going to say, that's enough. And we're going to adopt a different model. That's my prediction and my hope.
Decency, sir, at long last. Yeah, I see that happening at some point. There'll be a moment like that, and the tide will turn back. But yeah, I would have to agree with Esther. It is something to be worried about. And
I think technology enables it, as you said, in a lot of nefarious ways. I think it's the idea that eventually you might get a ticket for, you know, some spy cam catches you drinking a big soda or eating a Snickers bar when you weren't supposed to or something. That's it sounds funny, but it's not completely beyond the pale. You know, it's not completely outside of what we could imagine happening. And I don't want to live to see that. I want us not to have that happen. And ultimately, I think we'll swing it in a different direction. So, okay,
absolutely.
Let's move on. What do you got next?
Okay, neural. I thought I'd just throw in a completely sci-fi kind of thing. As we begin to augment our brains in various ways, adding the ability to access the internet straight from our neocortex or something like that, be able to experience virtual reality with a thought or augmented reality with a thought. If we can bring the internet to ourselves and therefore the world in, then perhaps the world can take a peek at us. I'd say that's a long-term worry, but I think it's something that's not too soon to begin thinking about. And what balance will we come to in that? So I thought that was an interesting worry.
And this was on the list, or this is one of yours?
Oh yeah, this is not one of mine. This is on the list, number 85.
So for some reason, I'm having a hard time sorting that one out in my head. Data privacy rights. So what's the
Well,
restate,
I mean,
data
privacy rights issues to our own data now, right? I mean, everybody's concerned that, you know, these Google algorithms that tailor searches to our particular taste, because they kind of monitor us, right?
Right.
And monitor your Gmail, maybe Google might, in order to tailor an ad just to you. Now, maybe they argue, well, there's a live person looking at your mail. We're just, certain keywords within your mail, and we'll show you this particular ad that we think that might...
Oh, I get it. And neural. So we're talking about they're actually going to get into our head.
Yeah, and then one...
Okay.
And then you take that, and then you insert it into your brain, and
right.
We're talking an invasion of privacy of the worst sort. And so I think it's not too soon to be concerned about that.
No, it's not. Well, they're currently reverse engineering our neural processes, aren't they? They're
right.
Reverse engineering them based on our behavior. And to some extent, we're saying that's okay. I think there's some pushback on that, but generally it's still allowed, and it's not, people aren't carrying torches in the streets objecting to it. But what happens when that bridge gets crossed and they're not just reverse engineering it, or when they get better at reverse engineering it, when Google knows you better than you know yourself, predicts your behavior better than you predict yourself, and suddenly it's like they're able to push the buttons, they're able to pull the strings, to mix my metaphors there. That's a very scary and dangerous thought. And they could probably get pretty good at that just by continuing to reverse engineer. But eventually, as you said, we're going to be hooked in. We're going to be jacked into this system. And then it becomes this question of how deep into the way our brains work and what's going on inside our brains are we going to be comfortable with them getting. And this reminds me of the conversation we had with Ramaz Nam a few weeks ago when we were talking about Nexus. And one of my big objections to Nexus was, I don't want anybody poking around inside my head, looking, you know, into my memories or touching parts of my memory or parts of myself that I consider to be private and I consider to be completely my domain. And that's talking about another individual person doing it. But when you think about a corporation doing it, it takes on a really creepy feel, doesn't it?
Corporation, government, your neighbor down the street, it's creepy all around.
It's creepy any way you look at it, yeah. Anything that is private that you're not willingly, voluntarily sharing, it's a violation. And there is a tremendous risk that goes along with all of the cool stuff that's going to be enabled when we're able to connect with the computer network in a much more direct way than we're able to now. Yeah, that is an excellent one. Now yeah. I'm really scared. Okay, I don't know. we're gonna be able to make it through this whole show. Okay, I've got. I've got several other interesting ones here. This is one that really caught my attention. Sam Harris, he's a neuroscientist, and he wrote, "We need institutions and cultural norms that make us better than we tend to be. It seems to me that the greatest challenge we now face is to build them." And he gives this long example. It's a really kind of chilling example about a guy who is put in prison, and he's in this instance is falsely accused. He never committed a crime. But once he gets into prison, he's brought into a world where all the incentives are there for you to become a violent, depraved, really frightening, scary person who this individual maybe never intended to be. Now, it's more shocking if that person is an innocent person who's been sent into prison. But even somebody who's, you know, screws up once, makes one bad mistake, and now they're in prison. Now they're in a system, as he describes it, where all the incentives are to, you know, it's like you need to join a gang. You need to become very reactive. You need to become probably violent. All as a means of keeping yourself from being beaten up or raped or worse, possibly killed. And that's a pretty scary and shocking analogy when he takes that and explains how much it has to do with a lot of other things that goes on. He writes, "A prison is perhaps the easiest place to see the power of bad incentives, and yet in many other places in our society, we find otherwise normal men and women caught in the same trap and busily making life for everyone much less good than it could be." And these are some great examples he gives. "Elected officials ignore long-term problems because they must pander to the short-term interests of voters. People working for insurance companies rely on technicalities to deny desperately ill patients the care they need. CEOs and investment bankers run extraordinary risks, both for their businesses and for the economy as a whole, because they reap the rewards of success without suffering the penalties of failure. Lawyers continue to prosecute people they know to be innocent and defend those they know to be guilty because their careers depend upon winning cases." And this is something Glenn Reynolds has been writing about lately. I don't know if you've been following.
Yeah.
He's got this article out. I think it's what's it called? Due Process When Everything is a Crime. It's really shocking when you've got a quota of how many people you're supposed to convict that you're trying to hit. The whole idea of whether the person committed the crime or what's the right way to treat that individual completely goes away. It's pretty interesting. And the last one he says, "Our government fights a war on drugs that creates the very problem of black market profits and violence that it pretends to solve." And these are great examples that I think just cascade throughout all of society. These are some of the top level examples, but you see this everywhere. You see this in schools. You see this in industry. You see it in society at large, that we aren't providing the incentives. Our system is frequently not set up to give the right incentives to get the behavior that we really agree or think, or at least say that we want to have happen. And I had not looked at it this way before, and as I ponder this essay, I think this is a huge challenge. This is really something that needs to be addressed, but it's something that you have to address almost at a cultural level, almost at a civilizational level before you can do anything about it.
Well, you know, I think that there are examples, counterexamples of, you know, particular cultures, you know, have the reputation of, you know, of being, you know, the super moms that, and it's particular Asian mothers and things like this that really
tiger moms.
Their
kids that was going on like a year ago.
About a year ago. And I think there's something to that. I think that there's a culture of people, and you know, it's not just Asian folks, but it's various cultures that really push their children to excel, and all of the you know, the kids that find themselves in home, their incentives are, you know, are built around you know, good things happen when I really, you know, put my all into my studying. And of course, it pays off for them throughout their entire life, you know, and the world benefits from that. And of course, they, you know, the tiger moms, they talked about how, you know, sometimes these kids will break down. You know, I'm sure that's true. I mean, there's, you can take anything to too much of an extreme, but you know, to have people that are really into you know, making sure their kids succeed, by and large, is a good thing. And you can see where that is paid off, and with in particular cultures and particular ways of, you know, living and stuff. You know, there's something I've mentioned a couple times, Bill. This idea that social networks could contribute to our virtue. You know, by another, and like keeping tab in some ways. So that, you know, I've got this. This number of goodness points, you know, because I've helped out
right,
friends,
right,
maybe even strangers. That's, you know, I think that there are ways to build technology that would incentivize, you know, helping each other. And not a bad thing. I mean, yeah, I think you've got there's an opportunity there to create new ways of interacting with one another that way.
I think that's a really good point. And even before a whole new incentive structure gets put in place, it's terrific, I believe, that the internet and social networks are helping to create awareness of how skewed our incentive system is sometimes. When I think about the fact that I had been reading up on this part about lawyers having bad incentives, particular lawyers having bad incentives, well, I've been reading about it in a blog. And some of these other issues, it seems like we are aware of them. It's not that it's completely unknown that our incentives aren't exactly set up right, that they're not structured exactly right. People do know it, and people are starting to take steps against it, which I find very encouraging. In spite of the fact,
right,
that the way it's currently set up is not great, and I think you make a really good point that people seem to understand cause and effect a lot better when it comes to something as basic and fundamental as raising their children. It's when you allow any kind of bureaucracy to emerge that the incentives start to go a little bit haywire on you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people in their own lives are going to, you know, they're going to have incentives around the right things. You know, if eating a certain food makes you ill, you'll stop eating that, right? You know, it's just like,
right,
a built-in barrier to engaging in certain kinds of behavior. If you don't like doing something, then you don't do it. If something brings you pleasure, then you do that thing. But if you do too much of it and then you lose your job, you don't like that. And so, you know, there's like rational incentives built in around an awful lot of basic life. But once you have, I don't know, a kind of a corporate structure, a bureaucratic structure, a governmental structure on top of regular life, it seems that's where things can really start to really go in some funky directions, and we start rewarding the very behavior that we claim that we don't want to have happen. And I've got if you don't mind me doing two in a row, my own contribution to this one, to this list, is a takeoff on this one. Because here's my own particular worry, and it's not about incentives in general, but it's about looking ahead to the future. My concern is that the incentives won't be in place to allow for the rapid emergence of life extension or post-scarcity, two of the things that we most cherish talking about on this program and writing about in The World Transformed. Yeah. These are the futures that we really want to bring about. And right now it seems to me that as a society, certainly our government and the way business is set up and even the way media treats these issues, all the incentives are structured in such a way that life extension is not valued as an end unto itself. It's not something that you're allowed to say. You know, if you're a doctor, if you're a serious doctor, you're not allowed to say that that's something that you a kind of service that you provide. If you're a scientist, it's not considered all that respectable to say that that's research that you're trying to get funding for. And post scarcity, obviously, in some ways, just kind of flies in the face of our whole economic model. So there are no incentives in place to create a post scarcity economy. Now, I actually think we'll get there, and I think we'll get the life extension too. But I think the incentives are set up precisely to keep those things from happening very rapidly. And it wasn't until I looked at it from the standpoint of incentives that I really started to get worried about these two things earlier today. I started thinking about these are the two that immediately come to mind. There are probably others, but those are the two that that I seem that I feel the most concerned about. It seems to me that all the incentives that are in place, or the kind of majority incentives, the mainline incentives that our society provides, they seem to run counter to either of those two things happening. Now, do you think I'm overstating that, or is that accurate?
Oh, I agree completely, Phil. No, I don't think you're overstating it at all. Sorry, I can't disagree. If I could, I would.
We're on the same page. So I then turn it around and say, so what are we going to do? And I think that the solution lies along the lines of, you know, somebody ought to do a weekly podcast about this stuff, right? I mean,
exactly. Yeah, let more people know about it.
The only thing we can do is to let people know that these possibilities exist, that they're real. That we will get there eventually, but that things need to be reordered in such a way that we recognize these as objectives that can be achieved, and we work on them as objectives that can be achieved, rather than as fantasies that realistic policies and realistic business plans have to be set up in opposition to. So, you know, if there's one silver lining on this, it's that this is a problem that you and I have been working on addressing for years now without even realizing that was a problem we were addressing.
And we're not alone in it. You know, there are certainly not.
Yeah.
Fortunately, there are many people that have been attempting to express, and Aubrey de Grey is one of them, you know, that, you know, maybe we should worry about some things that, and work on some things that, but change our goals, basically. Stop thinking of medicine as something that we deal with illnesses as they pop up, but rather we take care of ourselves before we get sick. And I think that model right there, which is actual health care instead of sick care, that is the beginning of what it takes, I think, to keep us rejuvenated and be able to attack the aging problem. I think that's part of the foundation of that. I really do.
I think so too. And I think that ultimately there's got to be a lot of money in 3D printers and some of these other post scarcity technologies to get us to the breakthrough that's going to get us to post scarcity. I really don't know how we're going to get there. I know that the technology is emerging, and we've talked about this before, and we can see the other side of it, but there's this black box in the middle that, you know, a miracle happens or everything breaks apart, everything shakes down, and then suddenly we come out on the other end and we have a post-scarcity economy. Interesting times lie ahead on that one, that's for sure.
I some shakeup involved there. Okay, my next one, number 109, that humankind's social and moral intuitions will stifle technological process. Now, this bill, there's some, you know, sort of definitely some politics tied up in this one, is there not? I think there's the issue of, you know, does the green movement get to stop our, you know, further technological development in this way or that way? And then, you know, and on the other side of the fence, I would suppose that people are to the left of center would be concerned about, you know, perhaps religious fundamentalists on the right side stifling, you know, the teaching of evolution in school, things like that.
Right.
I think that there's some legitimate concern that, you know, we don't stop the good things that are happening technologically by throwing too many of our preconceived notions in the way of it. That said, Phil, I think that there's a lot of momentum to our technological progress. I don't know that even, you know, well-funded movements and movements with a lot of political pull can stop the progress that we're seeing. But it's maybe they slow it and or warp it in some way that's not necessarily good for us. So I think it is a concern, and I share it.
Well, that one really puts me in mind of another one, and I was just scrolling through the list trying to find it. It's not jumping out at me, and I had actually added it to my list of things I was going to talk about, and then I thought the list was getting too long, and I took it off. I wish I had left it on there. But somebody very familiar, the name would immediately go, oh, him, said that he's worried that the future is going to involve this war between the druids and the engineers. And this is, I think, a very similar set of problems. Just formulated a little bit differently than it is in the one you read, where the druids are the kind of green, tree-hugging, holistic side of the world, the people who are, say, against genetically modified crops, okay, right, that crowd, right? And the engineers are like the pro-singularity people, okay, on the other side of the world, right? So it kind of divides, and, you know, it skews sort of between left and right, but not exactly. It skews sort of between traditional values and progressive values, but not really, because there's certain values that end up on either side. But there's the kind of put on the brakes versus put on the accelerator, where technology is concerned, where science and technology is concerned, and it's this ongoing struggle. And I think that it probably relates to the discussion we just had about incentives as well, because we probably don't put the right incentives in place necessarily to make the progress that we want to make where some of these things are concerned. So it's a really interesting quandary that we kind of get into, because there are probably some good valid arguments and some good valid concerns on both sides of these things, whether you divide it up between druids and engineers, or whether you divide it up between right and left, or, you know, buzzkills and techno weenies, or you know however you want to define the two camps. I think there's a lot of tension between the two, and there probably should be some tension. It's probably not entirely bad that we have breaks. Although I know you made the case a while back on one of our shows that we should be going full bore ahead with technology, because that's the best way to prevent the risks that might emerge from technology.
Right.
But putting that argument aside for a moment, we know that there are certain terrible outcomes that can occur from technology, and when some people are arguing in favor of technologies that can lead in that direction, we all, you know, you and I, we become druids, right? Even some people who are big-time singularitarians, big-time engineers, will say, well, no, not that far. I don't want that to happen. That's one particular thing where I would say, let's slow that one down a little bit. And at the same time, there are certain good outcomes that even the most backward and less technologically friendly folks are genuinely hoping to see fulfilled. One of the things we've talked about in the past is how the ability to have a child that you know won't be sick is one of the things, you know, that you know won't have birth defects or that you know won't have to suffer from certain kinds of conditions is one of the things that will probably create a climate that allows designer babies, that we'll be in a world that allows designer babies because parents want good things for their children. So there's kind of this common human interest that points us in the right direction, but it sure pushes us in a lot of other directions at the same time, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yep. All kinds of incentives going this way and that way. And yes, we should want to take care of the fragile planet that we're on, right? I mean, that's...
Yes.
You know, we all should have that as part of our incentive structure, our concerns or whatever. But, you know, I'm going to tell you some of the worst places I've ever I've been in my life as far as just environmental degradation. We're in, you know, in places that were not technologically, not westernized or whatever.
Right.
Places that, you know, where things were, you know, you basically had central control by, you know, I was in Eastern Europe about the time that the wall came down. In 91, I got to briefly go into East Germany. You know, just absolutely filthy. I mean, the, you know, it was just you know, no concern whatsoever for the environment. And then you go into West Germany, and it's just beautiful. You know, I believe that technology often helps us. It gives us the if nothing else, it gives us the wealth to allow us the concern for the environment, or to allow us to take care of the environment. So sometimes we are as virtuous as we can afford to be, and the technology perhaps gives us the wealth to afford to be more virtuous in that way. So.
Yeah, you should read the one about the druids and the engineers. I'll tell you, I think you'll agree. You and I are just big time engineers. That's all there is to it. But but you know, yeah. It's not that we don't want to accept some wisdom from the druids when they have some. And I don't think of them as enemies. I think of them as friends who also care about having a good future. Just going about it all wrong. That's their problem. Okay, so gosh, we're running desperately short on time. Give us another quick one. Or wait, is it
okay,
my turn?
Okay, I believe it's your turn.
Oh, okay. All right, I'm going to jump to the biggest one, which is I think actually tied to one that you had, and this is Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the author of The Black Swan, and also wrote a book about what was it called before that? Well, anyway. He's best known for the Black Swan. And he says, Black Swan events and the fact that we continue to rely on models that have been proven fraudulent. And I won't read an excerpt that I had taken from his essay. I'll just try to encapsulate it. Basically, it comes down to this. A lot of economic phenomena do not follow a normal distribution. They do not follow statistically what we'd call a normal distribution. They follow what's called a fat tail distribution. And anything that lines up according to Taleb is completely unpredictable. That basically the models don't work. He did serious research into this, serious mathematical research into proving that economic models are not predictive and are not valid for wide number of phenomena. He did serious mathematical research into this. He wrote a popular book about it that sold millions of copies. He makes the point, he's testified before Congress on this point a couple of times, and the thunderous response is chirping crickets. No one is interested in the fact that basically all of economics is based on models that are not valid, that he pretty much ranks as pseudoscience. So when you think about how much of government policy and how much of what businesses do is based on that kind of analysis, it's a really sobering and frightening thought to consider that there's all this math that probably isn't telling us that much at all, that probably is doing as much harm as it is good. And I find that to be a really frightening prospect, but also it speaks to an opportunity, which is that
if someone comes along with a better model, don't you think that it would be quickly adopted if it were shown be predicted?
Well, you would think, you know, if it actually worked, but the resistance that society seems to have to accepting the criticism in absence of that better model is worrying, right? You almost start to wonder, is this like a fondness that doctors still in the 18th and 19th century had for using leeches, you know, like the resistance that they had to germ therapy, right? I mean, you know, this germ theory, this guy comes along and he says, look, here's the scientific evidence that what you're doing doesn't work, and they don't want to hear about it. But a related item on the worry list that actually, when you put these two together, I think makes me feel a lot better about everything, was number 31, and it was, we should worry that so much of our science and technology still uses just fine main models of probability, even though there are more probability models than there are real numbers. And this was Bart Tosco. He's an information scientist. And he gives an analysis similar to what Taleb does, talking about what, you know, the limitations of these different kinds of models that we use, but at the same time pointing out that there are many more models that could be used. And ultimately, that speaks to the idea that something's going to come along and will actually work, and we won't face these risks. But in the meantime, I think we're in quite a bit of trouble, not just because the models we're using are bad, but because people seem to not want to face it. That there's a kind of a complacency about the fact that we don't understand what we're doing, but that we're sort of pretending that we understand what we're doing. And that's kind of the theme that ran through all of mine. Everything that I picked on all of these lists had to do with the way we think more than anything else. You know, I didn't talk about fire raining down from the sky or robots taking over or even zombie apocalypse, as much as I like that one. But these all have to do with what we have learned, what we are aware of, and how we're responding to those things. And I think that kind of leads, Stephen, to the ultimate one. I think the one that encapsulates the biggest worry of all, which is number 133. Why don't you share that one with us?
That is the ultimate worry. Number 133, there are known unknowns, but what we should be worried about most is the unknown unknowns. Kind of mentioned that on the last show, didn't we?
Yeah, we talked about that last week, and as soon as I saw that, there's Stevens. Yeah.
There's things that we know, and things we know we don't know, but it's the stuff that blindsides us that can be most, it should be most worrisome to us, and it's the things we have no clue. It just hits us out of the blue, and therefore we have no opportunity to prepare or to build a defense against. That's pretty much the ultimate worry.
That's the biggest worry. There's possibilities lurking out there that we just have no idea about. And as Taleb points out, that we blind ourselves to when we think we understand what's going on. We tell ourselves we understand what's going on, and our models don't really even cover what's going on. So there's an awful lot to be said for a greater application of imagination and for just a broadening of our thinking, that we need to start entertaining possibilities that we have not entertained before and see if we can't bring some of those unknown unknowns into focus a little, but certainly get a better handle on known unknowns and get a better handle on just how short of actually knowing what's going on we really are. I think if we can accomplish anything.
Last call.
Thank you, Erica. It's moving in that direction, and that
Absolutely.
Leads me finally to the one I want to leave on, which is on a more productive note. Number five, Dan Sperber says that the age of accelerating technology will overwhelm us with opportunities to be worried, which is another way of saying maybe we ought not to worry quite so much. And in fact, if you read through that list of 150 summaries, 10 summaries include the words that we worry too much or will worry too much. So you ask a lot of, you know, out of 150 of the world's smartest people, you ask them, what are you worried about? And they say that we worry too much. About 6% of those said that was actually the problem. So with that in mind, we're going to try to be more resilient. We're going to try to be more creative. And we're going to try not to worry too much. I think that's the key. Not more than about 20% of the time, as we said at the beginning. All right. And on that note, Erica, what's our music this evening?
My Mythical Town by Chris Floyd.
Chris Floyd singing My Mythical Town. Well, thank you, Erica, and thanks, Stephen, for putting that together. Thanks, everyone in the chat room and everyone listening to us via MP3 for being part of The World Transformed. We'll be back again next week at the regular time with an all-new show. And until next time, live to see it.